Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Tonight we examine why a challenging childhood can make you sick as an adult. In the late 1990s, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACE study, revealed that the more trauma a child experiences, the worse his or her long-term health outcomes. While this insight was widely considered groundbreaking, it has had a relatively modest impact on the actual care of at-risk children and adolescents. San Francisco's Bayview Child Health Center and the Center for Youth Wellness are different. They make an aggressive effort to integrate the insights from the ACE study by identifying and treating children suffering from chronic stress. What does this treatment entail? Why hasn't the ACE study inspired a revolution in healthcare? What are the physiological changes that occur during childhood marked by chronic stress? And what diseases are most frequently seen in adult survivors? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues and more is Dr. Keely Muscatel, author of the article How Stress Makes Us Sick. She is a social neuroscientist and a psychoneuroimmunologist and also a postdoctoral scholar in the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Health and Society Scholars Program at the University of California, San Francisco and UC Berkeley. Welcome, Keely Muscatel.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And on the phone, we have Dr. Vincent Felitti, the co-principal investigator of the groundbreaking Adverse Childhood Experiences study. He is a clinical professor of medicine at the University of San Diego and the founder and former chief of the Department of Preventive Medicine for Kaiser Permanente. Welcome, Vincent Felitti.
Thank you very much.
And also by phone, we have Tueri Anderson, a licensed social worker and the interim director of clinical programs at the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco's Bayview. She serves on the Alameda County Human Relations Commission and on the National Institutes of Justice inaugural scientific review panel for its Violence Against Women portfolio. Welcome, Tueri.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Later in the show, we'll invite you, our listeners, to call in and join our conversation. You can email us your questions right now at cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Vincent Felitti, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us what an ACE score represents? What are the components that make up an ACE score?
Well, we discovered accidentally, and certainly to our surprise, that there were 10 categories of adverse life experience that were really very common in an adult middle-class population, but which no one knew anything about, in large part because we've all been taught as children very effectively that nice people don't talk about certain things, and my God, certainly don't ask about them. So the ACE study really began as a result of a number of counterintuitive observations that we made in a major obesity program that we were running at Kaiser Permanente in San Diego, where we were able to take people down non-surgically in rather dramatic amounts of weight, approximately 300 pounds a year, non-surgically, incredible though it sounds. And we found that rather than being very pleasing and thrilling to people, as one would expect, in fact, it was often extremely threatening to people. And indeed, that what we perceived as the problem, obesity, was for many people actually a solution to problems that we knew nothing about, which problems related to adverse life experiences in childhood. And those, we picked the most common 10 ultimately when we realized we really needed to study this in more detail.
But what made you think that? You're doing a study of obese adults. How did you make the connection to these adverse childhood experiences?
Well, I think the first inkling was that we had a high dropout rate that was limited almost exclusively to people who were successfully losing weight. And the regain was often very rapid. Then, in speaking with people in some detail about their lives, we ran into all sorts of unexpected things, like histories of childhood sexual abuse, which were remarkably common, histories of major childhood physical abuse, of major emotional abuse, that is to say recurrent humiliation, of growing up in massively dysfunctional households, none of which, of course, anyone knew anything about, and these were certainly not in their medical records or in their medical histories. And ultimately, it became clear that we had stumbled into something of major magnitude with an enormously high prevalence. And the interesting thing was that obesity often appeared to be a coping mechanism for these various kinds of adverse experiences. For instance, if you need to de-sex yourself, gaining 100 pounds works fairly well. Not as well as 200 pounds, but it's clearly a step in the right direction, etc. And we recognize this in some way in our everyday speech. You think of the expression throwing your weight around, etc. So it was really through little bits of experience like this initially that we stumbled into all of this, and ultimately it was of such major magnitude that we recognized that it needed to be studied in a general population to see if this was at all prevalent in a general population and not something peculiar to obesity.
And you found what?
We found that it was remarkably common in the general population, but that no one knew that, and many people were convinced that it really would be quite improper, dangerous, etc., to even inquire.
Kelly Muscatel, I want to bring you in here. Can you explain what happens physiologically during stress, especially the chronic toxic stress we're talking about here, that can cause an impact on later health?
Sure. I think that's a great question. It's something that a lot of research is focusing on right now. How is it that these external experiences that happen to our life can come to affect our brains and our bodies in ways that many, many, many years later can show up as poor health? So there's this idea of the fight or flight response, for example, that I think most people are familiar with, where when you're faced with sort of an acute stressor, like, you know, having to give a speech or maybe run from a predator, you see increases in heart rate and blood pressure to help you try to escape that situation. People are also familiar with this idea of a stress hormone called cortisol that tends to increase in response to acute stress. But for these more chronic, ongoing situations, one of the most promising physiological mechanisms that may link them with poor health is inflammation. And inflammation is one of the body's first lines of defense against injury or infection. So if you get a cut, the area around it swells, it heats up, it turns red. That's because these proteins that are called pro-inflammatory cytokines are swimming through the bloodstream, going to that area to try to heal the wound. Well, what's interesting about inflammation is that it can occur widespread throughout the body, and it also can occur in response to purely imagined or psychological stressors or in response to these chronic ongoing negative conditions. So this increase in inflammation is seen in a number of our most common and costly chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease, rheumatoid arthritis, major depression. So it's hypothesized to be one of the perhaps primary links between adverse childhood experiences and poor health. And one other thing that people are particularly excited about right now is this idea of epigenetics. So we all have, we're familiar with DNA and this idea that, you know, you have this code that's embedded in your genes. But what's interesting is that genes can actually be turned on and turned off by methyl groups. And what some research is showing is that exposure to these stressors in childhood is associated with methylation of a gene that's involved in the cortisol response. And that's another way by which early childhood experiences through changing of patterns of gene expression could lead to poorer health later in life.
Dewey Anderson from the Center for Youth Wellness, I want to bring you in now to talk about your experiences actually using the ACE. How many ACEs do you typically see in the children who come to the clinic in San Francisco's Bayview District?
Thank you, David. That's a great question. I think it's really important for our listeners to note what the Center for Youth Wellness is.
Great. It would be terrific if you could start with that. Thank you.
Yeah, so the Center for Youth Wellness is part of a national effort to revolutionize pediatric medicine and to transform the way that society responds to children exposed to significant adverse childhood experiences and toxic stress, like my two colleagues just were speaking on. And it's also important to note that the Center for Youth Wellness is a health organization that is within a pediatric medical home that serves children and families in the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood in San Francisco. And this is our pediatric partner, the Bayview Childhood Health Center. In terms of your question, how many ACEs do we see? It really ranges. And what the Center for Youth Wellness does is we partner with the Bayview Child Health Center to screen children at the pediatric visit. So that's the first line of screening with the ACEs screen. And we have modified the ACEs screen to not only include Dr. Folletti's original ACEs questions, but some other ones that we're seeing within our communities. This can include things like homelessness, community violence, engagement in the child welfare system that have proven to be stressors for families and certainly are disruptive to attachment, and that can lead to poorer outcomes regarding toxic stress. So with that in mind, using the pediatric medical home as the first screen, we're really relying on the relationship with the pediatrician so that the patient and the caregiver can have a safe space to be able to report some things that may be going on in that child's life or that have happened in that child's life.
I would imagine there has to be a very high level of trust for someone to honestly answer some of the questions that would be posed by this.
Absolutely, and that's absolutely correct, David. And it's also important to note that even with that high level of relationship, there still is a lot of stigma with a lot of these ACEs that Dr. Folletti had mentioned. And even so, what we see is that people don't necessarily report everything in their life experience. That's a lot to put out there to your pediatrician. So we do the initial screening, and from that initial screening, our pediatric partners, we have a weekly meeting where we meet with our pediatricians and then all the clinical team members from the Center for Youth Wellness, which includes therapists, nurses, wellness coordinators, which are basically case managers, psychiatrists, and biofeedback clinician, to discuss the clinical presentation and the ACEs score. And so we will get ACEs scores sometimes as high as 8 or 9. On the traditional Folletti scale, and sometimes as low as 1, but with really extensive physiological and psychosocial symptomology.
And are families brought in to the treatment plans?
Absolutely. They have to be brought into the treatment plan because this is really about family systems and supporting, holistically supporting the entire family. So at the point of contact in the clinic, the pediatrician will introduce the Center for Youth Wellness and link that to the recent ACEs screen. So it becomes, we're trying to make it to become like a normalized screening assessment at a well child visit. So just as the doctor might ask, how many cups of milk a day does your child have, or how many hours of sleep does your child get, the pediatrician can then ask, how this experience that your child has gone through, what are you seeing from that? And this has implications for their overall long-term health, as we know from Dr. Folletti's study. And so at that point, the family is taken into the understanding that this is really about the child's health, and it's not about something that the parent or caregiver did wrong, and it's definitely not blaming the victim. So once the caregiver consents to engage with the Center for Youth Wellness, from there, it's hand-in-hand. We are treatment partners with the child and the caregiver to ensure that the child's health is the prime point of focus for our care.
And what are the types of treatment when you have a child who comes in with a high ACEs score? What are the types of treatment that the Center for Youth Wellness is able to offer?
Well, the Center for Youth Wellness has an entire suite of services available to families and children in our care. And that includes wellness coordination, which is a case management model. Our focus really is on wellness, and so we took the moniker wellness coordination because we don't see families as cases, but like I said, as partners in treatment. And wellness coordination is the focus on navigating systems to access basic resources. So so that we can reduce some baseline stressors for the family. We have wellness nursing also, which is the wellness nurses are the bridges to the pediatric partners and really take a focus on the physiological health care for the child. We also have therapy services, and we have different levels of therapy service. We offer child-parent psychotherapy, and we're piloting Q-centered therapy, which is a treatment that has been developed by Stanford and Dr. Victor Carrion and his team. And these are therapeutic modalities that are designed to address traumatic stress and toxic stress in children and parents. Within our therapy model, we offer individual therapy for both the child and the caregiver, dyadic therapy with the child and caregiver, and family therapy as necessary. We also offer psychiatry services for children and caregivers to focus on any medical issues that might need some psychotropic medications. And we also use the psychiatrist, our consulting psychiatrist, to help us rule out a presentation that might look like ADD or ADHD, attention hyperactivity disorder, which in fact it may end up being trauma or trauma presentation. We also have a biofeedback clinician, and this person is focused on working with children to help them tune into their body systems, to regulate their body systems in response to stress. So it's really a physiological self-regulation strategy. We also offer nutrition and exercise education and programming with some community partners.
Wow, that is a real soup-to-nuts services that are provided there, which is absolutely terrific for people in San Francisco. Dr. Felitti, I want to go to you now. Given really what your study had to say, are you surprised that more cities, that more neighborhoods don't have organizations like the Center for Youth Wellness serving them? Why hasn't this really taken hold on a broader level across the country? Of course, that is now beginning with all the attention that organizations like the Center for Youth Wellness are now getting. But why has it taken this long to grab the public's imagination and to actually begin to change healthcare delivery?
That's a good and a complex question. One answer would be the change in basic systems is slow. If one looks back, the acceptance of the germ theory of disease took a rather long time, as did the acceptance of anesthesia. So that's part of it. But another part of it is I think that we have all been taught as children very effectively that nice people don't talk about certain things, and my God, surely don't ask about them. I mean, many colleagues have said to me when we were starting on this, you know, you're crazy. You can't ask patients questions like that. My God, they'll be furious, and nobody will tell you the truth anyway. Well, that turned out to be massively incorrect, and we have done this now successfully on a very large scale and found that once we got over our own initial discomfort at doing this and then gained the information initially in adults by an inert mechanism, namely a very extensive and well-devised questionnaire filled out at home, not on some clipboard in the doctor's waiting room, that it was possible to get extraordinary amounts of intimate information from patients, and that even briefly discussing this with them in a way that made it clear that they were still acceptable people had demonstrable benefits on a large scale. But you have to do this to become convinced that this is possible, and most people haven't done it and are quite uncomfortable with the idea.
Let's take a quick station break, and then we'll talk some more. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight, we're discussing how childhood trauma can lead to adult illnesses with our guests, Dr. Vincent Felitti, the co-principal investigator of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, Dr. Keely Muscatel from the University of California, San Francisco, and Tueri Anderson from the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco's Bayview District. We invite you now to call in with your questions or comments. Have you had an adverse childhood experience that you feel has impacted your health? Are you a healthcare provider who has insight into using ACE findings in the treatment of your patients? We want to hear from you. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us your questions at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Keely Muscatel, I want to ask you now about the types of stress that these young children are facing. How is it different from the everyday stress that children everywhere experience?
That's a good question. I think when it comes to physiological processes, there's probably a lot of overlap. The issue is just more the extent to which these kids are activating those physiological systems, how often, and with how long they last. So you can imagine a healthy person might go through a stressful experience and sort of activate their stress hormones and their physiological processes, but be able to shut them down relatively efficiently and quickly once the stressor is over. But a lot of times what happens with children who are living in ongoing chronic stress or poverty is that they're unable to shut down the stress response in an efficient manner. And so they're just constantly exposing their bodies and their cells to these elevated levels of adrenaline and stress hormones like cortisol, which can lead to inflammation. So I think at this point, our best guess is that a lot of the physiological processes are similar. It just depends on the extent to which you're engaging those processes on a regular basis. And kids who are living in these adverse circumstances might be more likely to do that on a regular basis.
And are some children more susceptible to being influenced by this stress than others?
That's a great question. It's a really hot topic in this type of research right now. And there's an analogy that's also often thrown out about orchid children versus dandelion children. And the idea here is that some kids are sort of like orchid flowers, which are beautiful, but really difficult to grow, really susceptible to the environmental influences that they're facing, whereas other kids are dandelion kids who are more able to grow sort of in the cracks of the sidewalk and bloom up through even snowstorms. And so they may be less sensitive to the environmental influences in their lives. And there's a lot of research been focusing on trying to understand who those kids are and what their characteristics are at the genetic and the behavioral and the neural level. And I think we're just now beginning to see those data come out and trying to understand who are the dandelion kids versus the orchid kids, and are there ways that we can identify them early on and try and set them on courses for intervention if need be.
Because the treatments could be different depending on the type of person, just like all treatment really needs to be individualized.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right.
What does the initial research tell us about generally ways to mitigate toxic stress?
Well, I think it really does depend on the circumstance. And, you know, there's unfortunately, no one-size-fits-all stress reduction intervention. Just to echo something that was said earlier, I read a recent study by some researchers at Northwestern University and the University of Georgia, which showed that a family-focused intervention for African-American youth living in poverty at age 11, which increased the tendency of parents to be involved and warm and supportive of their kids led to reductions in inflammation at age 19. So this idea that by focusing on the family and the interactions between parents and kids, we might be able to mitigate some of the effects of chronic stress. I think another really useful strategy and one that could be more ubiquitous across the board is the idea of social support, and that having someone you can turn to and rely on both for emotional support to talk through problems and support you when you're going through a stressor, and also provide some practical support and advice can be really useful. And as my colleagues were saying, targeting that through a therapeutic alliance or a relationship with a doctor for a child who might not have that with someone in their community or with a parent could be a really also useful way of increasing levels of social support among these kids and buffering those effects of toxic stress.
Tuari, I'd like you to respond to that in terms of what you're seeing day to day with the young people you work with and how much that rings true with you.
My colleague is absolutely right, and it will be important for me to mention that the suite of services that I discussed earlier doesn't mean that every single patient will need those services. And we really, the onus is on us as part of our multidisciplinary treatment team to figure out what is going to be the most successful point of entry with that child, with that caregiving system. And we don't want to inundate the family with too many supports and have them be overwhelmed by it. And so that can mean that the first course of action is to utilize our wellness coordinator to build that social support, that practical support relationship to help families get onto food stamps or find stable housing. And then once there's some stability, just continuing to engage that family to offer them any other of our suite of services that seems appropriate to ensure that that family system, that caregiving system, is going to be able to support that child or the children within that system after the intervention is over. And so much of what the Center for Youth Wellness is doing are piloting and evaluating these interventions and trying to figure out what works right now. We're getting there.
Okay. Let's go to some of our emails and calls. We have an email from Tom who asks, how is the Center for Youth Wellness funded? It sounds great, but expensive.
Yeah. So I think my colleague, if I heard correctly, Dr. Folletti was talking about the cost per year for some of these health issues. And I really want the listeners to bear in mind the expense of chronic health conditions in adulthood. And then we have to put that side by side with prevention. And this is a very typical argument that prevention upstream always seems that much more expensive. And we really need to be forward thinking as a society about what is the true cost, not only in healthcare costs, but we can talk about the cost of future incarceration potentially for some of our families, our children, the cost and lost wages, lost productivity for our communities, and all of these costs far outweigh the upstream cost of doing a prevention effort at the pediatric level. The Center for Youth Wellness has a great development team and are diversely funded by some really thoughtful, pioneering philanthropists about to think about these kinds of costs and recognize that we need to change something so that we don't keep incurring these longer-term costs as a society.
Tom, we appreciate that email. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing how childhood trauma can lead to illnesses as adults with Dr. Vincent Folletti, the co-principal investigator of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, Dr. Kelly Muscatel from UCSF, and Tuari Anderson from the Center for Youth Wellness. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Do you have a question for our panelists about stress or chronic illness? Are you wondering if a child you know is experiencing chronic stress? We want to hear from you. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website at klw.org. Let's now go to the phones. We have Richard calling. Richard, good evening and welcome to City Visions.
I'm suggesting an approach, looking at this through a traditional Chinese medicine point of view, if I may. We have very clear early childhood developmental stages, along with a very succinct diagnostic paradigm, which then leads to pre-treatment, actually, ability with wonderful pharmacology as well. And our ability is to be able to predict the stressor outcomes later in a child's life.
So the question from Richard about Chinese medicine and how this is integrated. Tuari, on the ground, to what extent are you using kind of non-traditional medicine side by side with traditional medicine in your treatment?
Sure. So the Center for Youth Wellness is a very new organization. We're 2 years old, and at this point in time, we're still developing our programming and exploring all of these different healing modalities that may be seamlessly integrated into our care system of care. I think it's important to note that we are embedded in the pediatric medical home in a traditional Western medicine system. And so at this point in time, our focus is really on how do we support a pediatric medical clinic to be able to integrate patients into the Center for Youth Wellness system of care, and how do we make sure that our services are going to be aligned with the cultural values and system of the community that we're serving. That being said, we're very much deeply exploring the use of meditation and mindfulness as part of our healing modality.
And there is more and more research showing the effectiveness of those approaches on long-term health.
That's correct.
Wonderful.
Yeah, if I can just jump in there here and add regarding mindfulness, I think that's a potentially great sort of alternative medicine strategy. I don't know of many studies at this point that have looked at it in kids, but it certainly could be useful. And I think one of the ways through which mindfulness could operate in a way that's especially effective for kids who have experienced adverse sort of toxic childhood stress is via training of brain systems that are involved in helping us regulate our emotions. So we know that kids in toxic childhood environments are less likely to have these pronounced connections between brain regions that are important for being able to downregulate and control our emotional responses to stressful experiences. And those seem to be the same brain regions that are improved in functioning during something like mindfulness meditation. So that could be an excellent way to kind of train up these brain systems that might not have been fully developed for a kid who grew up in a toxic environment, and that could mitigate those effects on long-term health.
And Vincent, did you have a comment on this as well?
Well, I have no experience with children whatsoever, only with adults. So my experience has been looking at how this plays out roughly a half century later. And one of the things that we discovered, again to our surprise, was that helping people speak openly about their experiences was enormously beneficial, measurably so, particularly if it was done in such a way that it was clear to them that they were still acceptable as a human being. Mm. And so We had a study of 135,000 adults, average age 57, who were queried about the 10 categories of adverse child experience by questionnaire initially and then pursued in the exam room, essentially by a method, I see on the questionnaire that, can you tell me how that's affected you later in your life? And listening and implicitly accepting that individual. Much to our surprise, in a 135,000 patient study, in the year subsequent, there was a 35% reduction in doctor office visits and an 11% reduction in emergency room visits in that group of people. Now, the financial benefits of that are staggering.
Right.
Why that happened is a more complex question. Was it because people were, quote, healthier? I suspect not. I suspect because they were markedly less stressed. And then when one comes to the question, well, why do people see doctors? Basically, people see doctors because of anxiety about disease as opposed to disease per se.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we reduced anxiety significantly.
Very interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, this was really interesting because it was a brief intervention. We didn't even conceive of it as an intervention initially, but it had rather profound manifestations. So what more can be done with adults or more complexly with children is yet to be determined. So it's extremely pleasing to see things like the operations like the Bayview Clinic taking this on in a very serious manner.
Keely.
Yeah, if I can just build on that, I think the idea of disclosure and the importance of that is really key and important. And I think, though, the idea of face-to-face disclosure and having someone who's there to accept you and affirm that you're still a person of value and worth if you've had some of these traumatic experiences is true and important. There's also a whole body of research suggesting that just writing about traumatic experiences can really improve long-term health. So a whole body of research showing that individuals who are assigned to keep journals and write about the stressful experiences that they've had in their lives, the people who really take that to heart and try and make meaning out of what happened to them and the stressors that they faced are likely to show health benefits overall, and perhaps through these physiological mechanisms I mentioned before, like reductions in inflammation. So I think even something as simple as journaling and writing about stressors in your life can be really beneficial.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Marcus from San Francisco. Marcus, welcome to City Visions. Marcus, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
No problem. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. The question I had is, are there differences in terms of gender with respect to the impact of childhood trauma? You know, are boys more affected than girls?
Really not adequately studied yet. Certainly taking the single issue of childhood sexual abuse, we found the prevalence of that to be, by self-acknowledgement, 28% in women, and this is in a 17,500 middle-class adult population, and 16% in men. So, you know, that's a gender difference. Now, amongst those people so affected, is there a difference in outcome? Not adequately studied at the present time.
It may depend on the outcome. Also, there's some evidence linking adverse childhood experiences with more internalizing symptoms among girls. So those are things more like depression or anxiety, sort of internal emotional processes, whereas boys may be more likely to show externalizing symptoms like acting out or the types of attentional issues that were mentioned before. So it may depend on the specific outcome that we're looking at as well.
Tuari, in your work on the ground, are you noticing differences, and are there gender-specific responses that the Center for Youth Wellness has to these issues?
Sure. So, like Keeley just mentioned, there certainly is a gender difference in the presentation of internalizing and externalizing behaviors, where girls tend toward more the internalizing behaviors and boys are tending more toward the externalizing behaviors. And there's real implications for that because we're working with school-aged children. And so what we see a lot of are young boys who are having extreme difficulties in peer relationships in the classroom, and this changes and can escalate if not intervened with at an early point, and can escalate to really poor academic outcomes, including expulsion. And you know, there's a huge body of work and research happening right now on Boys and Men of Color initiatives and focusing on this in terms of the school to prison pipeline. And so in terms of a gendered intervention, one of the things that we think about is, and this is really for any child, so I don't want to say that it's gendered, we really want to look at where are the places where a child may be having some trouble and how can we support the child, the caregiving system, and that system that they're embedded in to ensure positive outcomes for that child. For example, if that means that our wellness nurses need to participate in an IEP process, IEP being Individualized Education Program process, to help educate the teacher, the school, and the family, and to support the child to ensure that he or she is successful in the classroom. What that also might mean is if we have a child that is internalizing a lot, and that might manifest as self-injurious behavior or being withdrawn and having poor peer social relationships because of that, we certainly can utilize our therapy services to support that child. So I'm a little reluctant to say that it's a gendered intervention. It's really what is the presentation for that child at that moment in time.
Got it. You are listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. We are talking about childhood trauma with our guest, Dr. Vincent Felitti, the co-principal investigator of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, Dr. Keely Muscatel of the University of California, San Francisco, and Tueri Anderson from the Center for Youth Wellness. We invite you to join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Let's go to some emails now. We have an email from Art in San Francisco who asks, what is the impact of the stress of war on children who are in war zones? How does it manifest and can it be reversed? Who'd like to take that one? And I would add, to what extent are we finding that the experiences of children in high violence inner city neighborhoods in the United States are similar or different than those of children growing up in war-torn countries?
Well, let me say something that, again, was unexpected. When we looked at the 10 categories that we studied of adverse childhood experience, so they were selected simply based, you know, on a clearly middle-class, middle-aged population. Much to our surprise, we discovered that the 10 categories were essentially co-equal in destructive impact, and that was quite unexpected. I believe that one would likely find the same sort of thing going on in people who are from war zones. They likely would be experiencing, you know, distinctly more categories of adverse life experience, but I suspect that the response emotionally and physiologically would be quite similar.
Okay, let's go to another question now. This is from Jake in Berkeley, who asks, what is considered an ideal childhood?
That's a very, very good question. I think one that is emotionally supportive and which also has adequate physical support in the sense of food, nutrition, medical care, etc. But the general lack, at least in the United States, is not so much of things like food and nutrition, but more in the realm of emotional support. I mean, that's strikingly lacking commonly, if one is so bold as routinely to inquire.
If I can just add also, there's a really interesting theory out there right now in the developmental psychopathology literature that suggests that there's really kind of this sweet spot of stress that you want to have in your childhood, that having obviously too much and the types of, you know, chronic toxic stress we're talking about is bad for you, but also that maybe having too little stress or emotional challenge might also be bad for you, and that we really want to hit this, what exactly that looks like, I don't know, but this sweet spot of having, you know, experienced enough stress that you learn that you can regulate your emotions and turn to people
resilience.
For support. Exactly. Turn to people for support, and that you have the resources at your disposal to overcome challenges and to look at situations that might be hard as less of a threat and something that you just can't deal with and more of a challenge and something to be overcome. So I think that's a really interesting theory at this point, and we'll see how will the data play out.
Let's go to another email from Nikki, who says, I'd like to talk about the effects on adults. I'm a care manager nurse for adults with multiple chronic conditions, and I imagine that the ACEs are more widespread than we think. Please talk about obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, especially hypertension.
Well, obesity is where this began, and it's an interesting prototype because what we learned there is representative of so many other realms of problems. For instance, the common phrase, you know, sit down, have something to eat, you'll feel better. Eating has psychoactive benefits. Okay, we have some sense of that, but what we don't understand generally is that obesity can be protective. Commonly so. It's sexually protective. That's sort of a no-brainer if you think about it. anyone who, well, I vividly remember a patient in about 1985 talking with her, going through her life year by year. We get to age 23. She tells me at 23 she's raped. In the year subsequent, she gains 105 pounds. And then she looks down at the carpet and mutters out loud, "Overweight is overlooked, and that's the way I need to be." Okay, so obesity is commonly sexually protective. It is physically protective. Around the same time, we had two men in the program who were guards at the state prison downtown. They lost between 100 and 150 pounds apiece. They made no bones about it. They were not comfortable walking into the prison regular size. They felt a lot better going in looking big as a refrigerator. And then it is socially protective. People expect less of you.
Well, I'd like to talk about another condition that I think some of those things could apply to, which is adult drug use. And what have you found, Vincent, about the connection between adult drug use and trauma?
And the best example there that most people will have quick understanding of is crystal meth. You know, everybody knows about the evils of crystal meth on the street. The interesting thing is that nobody seems to remember that the first successful prescription antidepressant medication, introduced for sale in 1940 by Burroughs Wellcome and Company, was methamphetamine. Identical chemical, but in pure form and known dose. And methamphetamine was essentially the major prescription antidepressant for approximately the next 18 years until the advent of tricyclic antidepressants in the late 50s. So does it mean anything that this demonized street drug, crystal meth, is also an effective antidepressant? Does it mean anything that nicotine has been known for almost a century to have potent anti-anxiety activity, antidepressant activity, appetite suppressant activity, and as American Indians knew empirically through their use of tobacco leaves in the ceremonial peace pipe, not moss or oak leaves, anger suppressant activity?
Going back to the original question from the email, I think another thing that we haven't talked about yet, but that's really important to think about here, is that a lot of these chronic diseases that we're seeing in adulthood among kids who have experienced toxic adverse stress are things like cardiovascular disease, obesity, stroke, those sorts of conditions, which all have an underlying inflammatory component. So levels of inflammation have been shown to be elevated in all of those disease states. And what I think is really unfortunate and interesting about that is that inflammation, even when it's in your body, can feed back to the brain and affect our perceptions of stress. So it's sort of this horrible cycle of sorts whereby, you know, the experiences that we have in the world that involve stress can lead to increases in inflammation, and those elevations in inflammation can lead us to perceive more stress in our lives. And so I think really understanding how that happens and working to decrease levels of inflammation could work to decrease our stress perceptions in the same way that we can also work on decreasing stress perceptions to lower inflammation.
Okay, let's go back to the phones now. We have a call from Shessa in San Francisco. Shessa, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. I had a little experience with biofeedback myself, and I thought it would be valuable to ask for some elaboration on how you used it and what some of the outcomes were that you found through biofeedback.
Tuari, sure. Do you want to talk about that some, about how you're using biofeedback at the Center for Youth Wellness?
Sure. So biofeedback is our newest intervention at the Center for Youth Wellness. So I do not have any outcome data at this point in time. Please stay tuned. And just to remember that biofeedback is part of a suite of services. And this is where we really rely heavily on the pediatrician to help us piece together what a good intervention will be based upon the physiological symptoms that the child may be experiencing. And biofeedback is relatively new to a lot of the families that we serve. So
can you explain to our listeners exactly what it is, exactly what we mean by biofeedback?
I will do my best, not being a medical professional. But at this point in time, biofeedback is...
Oh, we may have lost our caller, but we can cut that line and continue on with the answer, please.
Sure. So biofeedback is just that. The feedback from a computer monitor as that relates to your physiological symptoms. So a patient is hooked up to different machines, a biofeedback machine, that can monitor things like heart rate, respiration rate, sort of these autonomic system processes, and then that gets seen on a screen, and the biofeedback practitioner will start coaching the child or the patient to be more attuned to that. In fact, it's almost a mindfulness process, but utilizing our own physiology. And initially, they'll take some baseline information around the physiological metrics that the child may be experiencing, and then can also introduce some stressful scenarios, have the child see what's going on the screen, and then coach the child into reducing through different techniques, both in the clinic and with homework, to really work on regulating their own physiology to dial down that stress response.
Okay, we have time, I think, for one more call. Let's go to Peter in Berkeley. Peter, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Yes, what is your question, Peter?
I had an experience in the... Oh, I'm getting an echo. Maybe I have to turn my radio off. I'm sorry.
Okay, yes, that can be helpful if you turn the radio off while you're speaking.
Yes, sorry.
No problem. What is your question?
It's more of it's a comment first, and that is that when I was in the military before I went to college, I had 2.5 or 3 years of what I describe as very pleasurable stress. I had a high-stress job. I wasn't in danger. It wasn't in combat. I was completely out of harm's way. At about age 30, since about age 30, I've been clinically depressed. My current diagnosis is major depressive disorder. So I'm wondering if seemingly positive stress in big chunks like that over a long period of time can also have the effects that your team is talking about.
Kaylee, I'm wondering if that's the resiliency we were talking about.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I would say that it is true that positive stress sort of exists in this idea that you can have a lot of demands on your time, but if you appraise them as things that are welcome and challenging and that you have the resources to deal with, and you don't see the same types of physiological reactivity in those sorts of situations. So it would suggest that it was protective. Although one example that I think is really useful in this context is the idea of marathon runners. So there's some research showing that marathon runners and people who run these long distances repeatedly actually have elevated levels of stress hormones and inflammation in their bodies, even though they're presumably really healthy. They can go out there and run 26 miles, no problem. But the idea that even something that's sort of positive and good for you in the short term, if taken to the extreme, could lead to similar negative outcomes. So that could be something similar to what was going on with this person.
Tuari, I'd like to ask you about concerns about labeling when you do this assessment of young children. The assessment stays with them for life, and the score really can't change because the scores are based on things that happened in their childhood, of course, that they had no control over. Is there any concern that, say, the juvenile justice system or the child welfare system or some other system would get a hold of these numbers and then wanting to help these kids, feeling like they need help, pulling them into a system that they might be better staying out of?
Yes, David, I think that's a great question, and this is why it's important for your listeners to understand that the Center for Youth Wellness doesn't just do a clinical intervention. We are a multi-pronged organization that also has a research arm. Some of the things that Keely has been talking about are part of our research focus. And then we have a policy arm here, which is incredibly important to the work for the Center for Youth Wellness because it's really about all these different systems that children may come into contact with. And we understand that while we might be screening younger children, there are still families with children in our care who may already have encountered the juvenile justice system. And so it is incumbent upon us to share our findings, to share our knowledge with these different fields so that we all can be on the same page about how to support these children and their families, because all of these systems were designed not to catch kids up, but to support them to live full and productive lives. And so I think if we can really align on that value system and that purpose, that is what we're looking to do.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left, and I'd like to ask each of you this question, because you all spend a lot of your time thinking about, studying, and providing interventions about the impacts of stress on people. Has it made you each change your own behavior in any way to have this be something you're facing and thinking about every day? Keely, let's start with you.
That's a great question. I guess for
getting
me,
that PhD had to be stressful.
It definitely was. And actually, it was a perfect example of what I was going to say, which is I was been really affected by those great 1960s social scientists, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, who said, "I get by with a little help from my friends," which is definitely true in my life. And I rely a lot, I think, on social support and the help and just general supportiveness of my family and my friends. And I feel really fortunate to have such a great support network and just being sure to turn to them when I am stressed out, like when getting a PhD. But also some awesome work by one of my close colleagues at UCLA showing that it's not just about receiving support when you're stressed out, but also giving support to other people. And that by I'm trying to, you know, be a good girlfriend, a good daughter, a good family member, and that can actually buffer against the effects of stress, too. So not just turning to people when you need it, but also when you might be stressed, sort of taking yourself out of that situation and trying to support other people in your life can also be really stress buffering.
Tuari?
I completely agree with Keely, and I'll take a little bit of a different frame. As a manager, it's extremely important for me to focus on supporting my staff within the organization to continue to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of my work is looking at how do we become a trauma-informed system of care and give and receive, like Keely was saying, support for one another so that we can continue to do this work with the children and families that we want to serve.
Vincent, we have about a minute left. You have the last word.
Yes, oftentimes people have said to me, "Oh, isn't it depressing to hear these terrible stories all day long?" Absolutely not. What was depressing was being responsible for the care of people who had problems that I didn't understand. Coming to an understanding of these things, which are so common, really has made an enormous difference in terms of allowing me peace of mind and hence greater effectiveness, which I think transmits to patients in terms of dealing with these issues.
Well, thanks to all three of you so much for joining me this evening. That is our show. Our guests tonight were Dr. Vincent Felitti, the co-principal investigator of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, Dr. Keely Muscatel of the University of California, San Francisco, and Tuari Anderson of the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco's Bayview District. Thanks all our listeners for joining us this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us next Monday for a rebroadcast of our recent show about San Francisco's neighborhood blogs. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.